Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2019 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, what does Kevin McCarthy's potential to be the next Speaker of the House mean for the Valley? And what about some other big local races that are starting to heat up? We'll talk politics with political science professor Thomas Holyoke. We'll also explore why assaults against teachers perpetrated by students are a big problem right now in the Kern High School District. Harold Pierce from the Bakersfield Californian will join us. Plus, we talk with the author of a new book called Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. It's a controversial take about programs that are supposed to help those in poverty, but author Andy Fisher says some groups are more concerned with perpetuating their existence instead of solving the hunger problem once and for all. Right now, though, we begin with a different sort of story, one that's about water but goes far beyond that. The San Joaquin Valley struggles with environmental pollution. Hundreds of thousands of residents are served with water that's unsafe to drink, and all of us live under seasonal clouds of ozone and particle pollution in the air. Water and air problems are regulated separately, but one contaminant presents a major problem for both. FM89's Carrie Klein tells us why nitrogen is such a persistent problem.
Let's walk in here, so we'll cut down the middle.
Every other Wednesday, John Hubble carefully crosses a field of garlic, plucking leaves off of tall, green stalks.
Usually it's the third or fourth leaf from the growing point. So there's one, two, three, and this would be your most recently mature leaf.
So it's not the youngest leaf, but it's the most recently mature.
Yeah, most recently mature. It's just a little bit more stable.
He works for an agronomist in Fresno, sampling crops and soils and sending them off to a lab for testing. It's what brings him to these rows of garlic in Five Points on the west side of Fresno County.
That's kind of one of the perks with the onions and garlic because it at least smells good.
The test results get sent back to growers like John Diener, who farms 4,000 acres of tomatoes, onions, grapes, and the garlic Hubble is sampling today.
This is the desired, and this is the actual.
Every few weeks, Diener pours over those lab results.
I do tissue samples on my crops, primarily because I don't want to overspend on nitrogen.
Nitrogen, an essential ingredient of fertilizer that helps plants grow and can increase yield. These data help him tailor how much fertilizer to apply. But Diener knows carefully applying nitrogen doesn't just help his crops. It also helps protect groundwater. You see, nitrogen leads a double life. It is a critical plant nutrient, but over the last few decades, we've come to realize nitrogen poisons water. And emerging research shows it's a contributor to air pollution. These impacts have spurred on a massive effort to train growers to reduce their nitrogen footprint.
The nitrogen usage on the farm, the farmers have always been aware of, right? What has accumulated in the soil over the eons, they're not.
But even with all this attention, it's extremely hard to fix, and it's become a lingering problem. Nitrogen is a major component of not just fertilizer, but also sewage and manure. Any nitrogen not sucked up by plants can get picked up by water and converted into nitrate, which can leach into soil and underground aquifers, which we drink from. Debbie Orrs is a staff attorney with the nonprofit advocacy group Community Water Center.
Nitrates in drinking water can cause a whole host of health problems.
Those range from blue baby syndrome, in which babies don't receive enough oxygen, to blood disorders and reproductive complications. A 2012 UC Davis study estimated that more than 250,000 people in Central California were at risk of public health problems from nitrate exposure. Since then, almost 300 water systems have had issues with nitrate, impacting as many as 390,000 Californians statewide.
You know, this is a problem that's not going away, and it is impacting more and more communities every day.
The State Water Board has been regulating nitrate in drinking water in some form since 1977. But in 2012, it instituted an ambitious set of regulations to tackle the biggest source of nitrate, agriculture. It's part of the Irrigated Lands Regulatory Program, which regulates 30,000 growers in the Central Valley. Patrick Palupa is with the Central Valley Water Board.
Those orders probably represented one of the most significant changes in how the regional board and the state boards regulate nitrate discharges that could affect groundwater.
The regulations require growers to create nitrogen management plans in an effort to apply only as much as the plants need. Many growers like John Diener have been doing this for years, but Palupa says the program has helped growers understand the greater impacts of overapplication. And he says many have changed their practices.
The communities that they depend on for their farm work are the same communities that may be drinking impacted water. So it's best to work towards solutions that work for everyone.
Jay Lund of the UC Davis Center for Watershed Sciences agrees progress is being made, but he warns we've still got a long road ahead of us. Unlike other contaminants, nitrate sticks around in the water supply for generations, becoming a legacy problem.
Even if we had magic that would stop any nitrate from crossing the surface into the groundwater today, we might not see the benefits of that for several decades.
With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Carrie Klein.
The city of Fresno has long relied on groundwater to meet its needs, but a new surface water treatment plant is slated to begin operating this summer. Valley Public Radio's Laura Tsutsui reports while the city faced complications with their last treatment plant, they're hoping the lessons learned there help solve problems this time before they start.
So a quick overview would be the raw water would come in here, goes in some pipelines.
Fresno's new Southeast Surface Water Treatment Plant is huge and built to do one thing, treat water from the Kings River and send it out to Fresno residents. Ben Carlisle is the construction manager for the site. He's giving us a tour.
Water will run through here, serpentines through.
We're standing on top of the structure that kind of looks like a giant concrete fort. We look down into basins that will eventually hold water. Right now, they're empty. The building sits on nearly 50 acres of land in southeast Fresno and is one of the biggest projects the city has undertaken. When it's up and running at full capacity, it should be able to treat 80 million gallons of water a day, more than twice the amount the city can treat now. The whole process is part of the Recharge Fresno project. Mike Carbajal is the planning manager with the city.
And so historically, Fresno has relied primarily on our groundwater supplies. And over the last 80 years, we've seen groundwater levels decline over 100 feet. And that means our wells have to be drilled deeper. We have to buy more energy to lift that water in order to deliver it to our customers.
The idea is to make Fresno more drought resilient.
It will allow our groundwater tables to recover and make the most beneficial use of our surface water supplies that the city has been investing in over a number of years.
By using surface water from rivers and snowpack melt during wet years, the city can let the wells rest and replenish. So when the next dry spell hits and surface water is limited, Fresno can use groundwater. This southeast location isn't Fresno's first plant to treat surface water. In 2004, the city began operating a plant in northeast Fresno. Soon after, some residents saw discolored water coming out of their faucets. The problem wasn't widespread, but it was concerning. Cassie Chahan is with the State Water Resources Control Board. She's been working with the city in development and implementation of this plant and also was involved in development of the northeast facility.
At the time, we didn't really recognize that there were any challenges. Later, it was discovered that there were concerns, and fortunately, the timing was great in that we were able to take any lessons learned from Northeast plant and apply those same lessons learned at the Southeast plant to hopefully avoid any discolored water concerns in the Southeast Fresno area.
She says that the city is making sure the chemistry of the water, once it's treated, doesn't impact the pipes like it did with the Northeast plant. The Southeast plant will be serving the oldest part of Fresno, and that could create some problems. To prepare, the city has been flushing the water mains. In some places, water will be running in different directions. The city says residents may notice higher water pressure once the plant is running. They've been working to avoid problems, but the city admits that some parts of the system are really old.
If we do have impacts, we will have a very robust reporting system where reports will get documented and recorded and addressed in a very timely manner so that we don't have anything that has potential to go on for a long period of time unnoticed and untreated.
Cordy Qualley is a faculty fellow at Fresno State, and he's spent years in the water resources industry. He says treating water can be a tricky business.
Treating water is a highly technical endeavor, and in order to do that, you have to get a lot of things right. It's not by the seat of the pants. There's a lot of testing and a lot of experience that goes into this, but nothing's exact. And you don't know what's going to happen until you put it out into the wild, so to speak, and see how things mix up.
Not only can it be challenging to get the chemistry right, but Qualley says treating surface water compared to groundwater is expensive. The whole Recharge Fresno project costs nearly $450 million. In 2015, Fresno increased the water rates to help pay for this project as well. So if the cost of accessing, treating, and distributing surface water is higher than the cost to use groundwater, why do it?
It is one more bullet in the gun that helps us have a sustainable water system or supply for the community. Fresno's trying to do their part to reduce their groundwater use so there's more water, groundwater to go around.
The Southeast Surface Water Treatment Plant is almost finished, and the city is also making sure the residents are ready. Officials are holding community meetings next week to explain the transition to residents. Mike Carbajal, again, with the City of Fresno.
They are our eyes and ears out there, and so as we go through it, if there are any questions or they see anything that doesn't seem quite right with the water, we want to know about it.
The city hopes to run the plant at full capacity this summer, and moving forward, they see the glass as half full as they prepare for the next drought. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Laura Satsui.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. House Speaker Paul Ryan shocked the political world last week when he announced he would retire in 2019 after the midterm elections. Of course, in most years, that would be huge news that would dominate the political news cycle. 2018 shaping up to be a little different, though, and it quickly faded from the headlines, but it's still a big story here in the Valley. Of course, because of the man who is likely to be Ryan's successor. Joining us now to talk about that and some other local and regional political issues, we have Fresno State political science professor Thomas Holyoke. Tom, welcome.
Good morning, Joe.
So Kevin McCarthy endorsed last week on the Sunday morning programs by Paul Ryan as his preferred choice to be the next Speaker of the House. This is a little bit of deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra would say. Back in 2015, I recall having a very similar conversation with you. How is McCarthy different this time?
That's right. Last time when John Boehner was essentially forced out of the Speaker's chair, and the Republicans were scrambling a bit to figure out who would actually take over because there was no clear successor. At what point, Kevin McCarthy, who's already in the leadership as the whip, came forward, but then accidentally mentioned on air that maybe the investigations into Hillary Clinton and her email were politically motivated. And after that, his stock with the Republican caucus went down a little bit, and they had to turn to Paul Ryan to take on the speakership.
And of course, Ryan was something of a reluctant speaker at that time, and political winds have continued to change since then. McCarthy, though, even back then in 2015, had some critics on his right from the Freedom Caucus members of his own party. Has his stance with the most staunchly conservative members of his party, has that changed at all in the last 2 years with the Trump administration now in office? A lot of them are very critical of the omnibus bill that the president signed and McCarthy helped get through.
No, I actually do not think that McCarthy has improved relations with the Freedom Caucus a whole bunch yet. And that's being reflected in a couple of ways. One, the current majority whip, Steve Scalise, Scalise has more or less said he'll support McCarthy this time around. It seems to be a little on the reluctant side and could emerge, I think, is still a challenge. More importantly, the leader of the Freedom Caucus, Congressman Jordan, has said that he is exploring a run for the speakership. It's unlikely he would win, but he could pull enough votes away from McCarthy to deny McCarthy the speakership and actually throw the entire Republican leadership into chaos. In other words, the Freedom Caucus is basically telling McCarthy, we've got some demands that you're going to have to meet if you want to be the Speaker of the House. So McCarthy has a lot of work ahead of him in trying to really unify the caucus behind his candidacy for the speakership.
McCarthy is a great fundraiser by all accounts amongst members of his caucus. He works the room really well. He knows all these details about everyone, and he uses that to his advantage in negotiations. He was a protege, or he helped understudy Kevin Spacey for his famous role, and that quote that McCarthy provided him, you know, vote your conscience, vote your district. This don't surprise me. The role of being a whip or a majority leader, does that automatically transfer in skills to being a good House speaker or an effective Speaker of the House? Is there a different skill set there, a lot more on camera?
There are some differences there. I mean, when you are whip and majority leader, you are essentially responsible for organizing the majority caucus. And to a large extent, that's a behind-the-scenes role. The speaker has two interesting roles which are not entirely consistent with each other. One is to be the public face of the Republican Party or the majority party in the House, but the speaker is also responsible for the well-being of the entire House of Representatives. And sometimes that works a bit against being leader of the majority party. And Paul Ryan has struggled a little bit with that while trying to wear both hats simultaneously. Indeed, that's part of what probably brought down John Boehner, because Boehner knew he needed to get some things done for the best interests of the country, and that set parts of his caucus against him and tore him to pieces and brought him down. So McCarthy's going to have to find a way to really walk both those planks simultaneously, and that's a hard thing to do. And he has to be the public face of the House and of his party.
And that means communicating on television and other new media that's out there now. McCarthy has not really ever faced a serious political challenger in his district. Very popular in his district in Bakersfield. Certainly many people don't like him. But overall, you look at the vote totals, and it's been resounding wins all across the board. Is it maybe a concern potentially that he hasn't been tested in that type of a tough contest? And does that reflect in any way in the heat of Washington politics?
That could be a concern for some House Republicans. McCarthy's district is a safe district, safe for Republicans. And so unlike Paul Ryan, you know, remember Paul Ryan had to go through the entire experience of being Mitt Romney's running mate. And so Paul Ryan got very tested on the national stage before becoming Speaker. And yeah, Kevin McCarthy has never had to go through anything like that. So there may be some doubts in the Republican caucus whether McCarthy is truly experienced enough, really has the thick skin or steel spine necessary to lead the Republican caucus through what is a very, very difficult time. After all, the Republicans are fighting to hold on to their majority in the House of Representatives.
And speaking of the House seats that are up for contest this year, one of them locally that's drawing the most attention is that currently held by Tulare Republican Devin Nunes. There's been a lot of national attention, of course, on Nunes due to his role in the House Intelligence Committee and as a supporter of the president and with the Russia investigation in the House. But his challenger, one of his most high-profile challengers, because there are many, but Andrew Jantz has brought in a lot of money recently. At one point, does that start to really make a difference? Nunes has such a sizable war chest, over $4 million last I checked.
Yeah, Congressman Nunes is probably not quaking in his shoes yet, but the challenge from Andrew Jantz is one that he would need to take seriously. This is probably the biggest most serious challenge that Congressman Nunes has ever had to face since initially being elected to the House of Representatives. Andrew Janz has been able to raise a lot more money than people have in the past. And a lot of that is because Devin Nunes has taken on this very high profile nationwide, and one that's received a lot of attention and a lot of negative attention, which has been able to make it easier for Andrew Janz to raise significant amounts of money, as well as level some charges at Devin Nunes that Nunes is so interested in having a national profile that he's neglecting his district.
Certainly one that we're watching. In fact, the Janz campaign already starting to put out some contributions to other Democrats in other races, a sign of the type of money they have coming in right now. If you're the Nunes campaign looking at his district, which encompasses much of Tulare County and then all the way up into the Clovis area and a portion of North Fresno, what are sort of the areas that are most contentious here, this looking at the individual parts of the district? What's going to decide this?
Well, Jan seems to be concentrating a lot of his efforts right now sort of in the Clovis area.
Why is that?
Well, I think it's more his natural base, actually.
But Clovis has a reputation of being pretty conservative, and I've been struck by the same thing. All of his messaging seems to be focused on Clovis.
I think Janz is feeling that Devin Nunes probably has not made much of an effort to engage voters in Clovis, that there's been all the accusations made that, you know, Devin Nunes is not holding town hall meetings, that, you know, Devin Nunes's office in Clovis is never open, that Devin Nunes has effectively no presence in Clovis, and even making the argument that Devin Nunes has abandoned voters in Clovis. So I think Janz feels that is the best opportunity for him to make some inroads against Devin Nunes.
But that overall district still on the relatively safe side at this point, and nothing significantly has changed in that level?
I don't think so. I mean, the
pull out our crystal ball here.
the district still leans Republican. It went for Donald Trump pretty heavily, as I said a moment ago. I don't think Devin Nunes is quaking in his shoes quite yet.
Speaking of quaking in his shoes, what about David Valadao, T.J. Cox, a late entrant into that race after Emilio Huerta pulled out? Huerta lost resoundingly to Valadao, who is so strong in Kings County and his home base there, but also does well and surprisingly well, according to some, in Kern County. Does Cox really have any sort of chance there, especially given his lack of name ID in the South Valley?
David Valadao, this interesting phenomenon, a Republican who continuously wins in a Democratic heavy district. I do not believe at this time that T.J. Cox is a formidable challenger. I actually think Emilio Huerta might have been able to do a bit better. Now, having said that, Valadao is also in a bit of an odd position right now, given the new farm bill that's being worked on in the House of Representatives. On the one hand, farmers in Valadao's district would really probably like to see this farm bill go through, but the farm bill is also making some changes to the SNAP program. It's a program that provides a lot of nutritional assistance to a lot of low-income people, and according to a report I heard this morning, there's about nearly 500,000 people in Valadao's district who could be potentially affected by changes to the SNAP program. Specifically, that the way the farm bill is shaping up, Republicans want to put a large number of work requirements in order to qualify for the SNAP program, and that could adversely affect a lot of Valadao's constituents. So Valadao needs to be a little careful on that, and that's something that Democrats could exploit. But again, you know, Valadao has shown many times that he is able to effectively and handily beat back any kind of challengers that the Democrats throw at him. I mean, Amanda Renteria a couple of years ago was supposed to be this incredible challenger, that the dream candidate of the Democrats, and she was crushed by Valadao.
Be very interesting to see how that shapes up. Moving a little more locally now, looking at something that's happening. In fact, we mentioned Emilio Huerta. The story is potentially that Huerta has his sights on a seat on the County Board of Supervisors because redistricting has taken place. MALDEF, the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Education Fund, sued county supervisors there over a district line, saying they intentionally disenfranchised Latinos. They lost that legal battle in federal court in Fresno, and new lines have been drawn, creating a second Latino-majority district there and setting up a November election fight. Now, the Dolores Huerta Foundation has issued a similar legal threat to Tulare County, telling them the same thing, that lines that have been drawn intentionally disenfranchise Latino. And there's no current members of the Tulare County Board of Supervisors that are Latino, despite the fact that 64% of Tulare County is Latino. How significant are these things viewed in context? Plus, there's also an issue with the Kern High School District that's similar. But is this a signal of something significant happening locally?
We've been seeing this happen the last decade or so in a variety of situations here in the Valley. For Board of Education seats, city council seats, and now county supervisor seats, that the accusations are being made that there's been some gerrymandering in these districts to disenfranchise Latinos, when in fact Latinos, given their geographical concentration, ought to actually have their own districts. And that accusation seems to have some merit, given that there's been some court rulings in support of creating Latino-majority districts and breaking up districts that were cutting through Latino communities. So this has started to reshape the political structure of the Valley and will result in more Latinos being elected to a variety of offices, Board of Education, City Council, County Supervisor, which in the long run means that we'll probably see more Latinos moving into higher offices. They get themselves started on the lower political rungs.
Is Fresno County at the same risk for such legal action as Kern and Tulare, or is it a little different here?
You know, I'm not sure that Fresno County is quite so much at risk. I haven't had a chance to do any kind of a detailed analysis of the way the supervisor districts are drawn, but I don't get the feeling that they really break up Latino communities to quite the same extent. And, you know, we've had, Latino representatives on the Board of Supervisors before with, Henry Perea. So I'm not sure Fresno County has quite the same problem, but having said that, I think every Board of Supervisors at this point and every city council and every school district needs to take a close look at how their districts are drawn, because they could draw challenges in the future.
We've got a couple minutes left before we go, and I want to turn to Fresno city politics right now. Two competing proposals, one that's out publicly and one that's sort of in the open discussion but not formally announced stage, for competing sales tax increases to fund different things. One that would fund parks and arts, that's being advanced by the Central Valley Community Foundation and a number of groups under that umbrella, led by former Fresno Mayor Ashley Swearingen. And then another proposed sales tax increase that would be funding public safety. Mayor Lee Brand has signaled that he would likely support such a sales tax, and others are lining up there as well. How does this complicate the 2018 election season here, especially given two competing taxes? I guess there's four potential outcomes there, looking at it, and candidates have to take a position here.
Sure, and actually a little bit of disclosure here. I am on the board of directors of the San Joaquin River Parkway and Conservation Trust, which is endorsing the parks bond. This complicates things in a number of ways. These bonds need... these proposals essentially need two-thirds support, and that's a pretty high threshold. And voters are never really in the mood to raise taxes. So with two competing proposals out there, that really makes it can make it pretty difficult that either one would pass. They could both harm each other. Now, one of the other interesting things is that anybody running for city council right now is going to probably have to take a position on these things. And that could complicate some of the races, because if voters are getting a little iffy about the question of raising taxes, that might push city council candidates to oppose both measures, and that could, you know, really reduce the chances that either measure would succeed.
Also, is it interesting, the city just passed this new Parks Master Plan in January. It identifies a need for a lot more funding tens of millions in deferred maintenance. And it says new revenue sources are needed. The existing general fund simply can't devote that type of attention to parks. Does that put existing city leadership, even if they aren't up for re-election this year, does that put them in a little bit of a bind?
Well, it certainly should. I mean, it's well known that Fresno has a very serious green space problem. We need more parks badly. We need to do a better job maintaining the parks that we have. The city keeps saying it's strapped from cash and more revenue is needed. This parks bond is certainly a way to do it, and the city should feel under pressure to, you know, improve and expand its park system, and this is a good opportunity to do so.
We'll see how it plays with voters in November and see if it gets on the ballot. Signatures are being gathered right now for that as we speak. Again, Fresno State Professor Thomas Holyoke joining us for our politics talk today. Tom, great as always.
Always fun, Joe. Thank you.
And stay with us. We'll be back in just a moment here on Valley Edition. And we'll talk with the author of a new book called Big Hunger. He suggests that hunger organizations are too close to corporate America, and that's creating a conflict. That and more coming up in the next half of our program. You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. Hunger is a big problem across America, but especially here in the San Joaquin Valley. One of the local groups taking on the issue is FoodLink of Tulare County. The Exeter-based organization is dedicated to bridging the gap between health and anti-hunger relief efforts. On Friday night, the organization is hosting a special event with Andy Fisher, author of the book Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. Andy joins us now to talk about his book and his thoughts on this issue. Andy, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Joe. Appreciate it.
You write that the hunger industrial complex, hearkening back to Dwight Eisenhower's farewell address about the military industrial complex and the dangers there. You write that the hunger industrial complex and the relationship between corporate America and major food banks and other efforts to address this issue is also part of the problem. How does the system work? Before we get into the why, how does the current relationship between those groups work in your estimation?
Sure. I would split this up into two pieces. First of all, if you look at federal food programs, we have 15 federal food programs. And as I mentioned before, it's the food stamp program or CalFresh, WIC, school lunches. About $85 billion is what the nation spends every year on those programs. And those programs are doing great work. They're very much focused on relieving the food insecurity of the public. But what we don't often ask is where that money goes. And that money often ends up in the pockets of Walmart, ends up in the pockets of Tyson. It ends up in the pockets of big food and ag companies who often don't have the most ethical practices or whose own wage practices are not enabling the food security of their workers. So you see these deep connections between the anti-hunger community who are protecting those programs and federal and the food industry who's also protecting those programs because it's in their own interest. Just one example of that is in 2013, the food industry spent $66 million lobbying for SNAP, for the CalFresh program, which is, you know, great on one level because it's protecting that program from being cut, but it's also protecting its own profits. The second part of that equation is you see that the supermarket industry and the food industry and even many corporations outside of food and ag are very tied into food banks. They're very tied into charity. And they do so through contributing food, through contributing billions of dollars worth of cash, and through contributing volunteers and expertise into that system. You know, one level on the surface of it, that's fantastic. You know, they're showing their community spirit, their goodwill, their sense of paying back to the community. But on another level, many of them, again, don't have the best practices, and they're trying to whitewash their unethical behavior with these donations.
What unethical behavior? Give me an example here.
Sure. Walmart is perhaps the easiest example. Walmart, until recently, had a $9 an hour starting wage. It recently put that up to $11 an hour. It does not let a lot of workers get full-time hours, which they consider to be 32 hours a week. So it doesn't have to pay them benefits. It actively encourages its workers to go onto food stamps to go to the food bank to make ends meet. And then Walmart turns around and is the single largest redeemer of CalFresh, of SNAP in the country at about $13 billion. And it gets a lot of earned media every time, and it pumps up and it gives a lot of contributions to food banks and the like, and every time it does so, it gets a lot of earned media, gets a lot of publicity, talking about how it's a wonderful hunger fighter when indeed it's causing hunger through its poor labor practices. Well, you know, I looked at employment data in Ohio, for example, which talks about which issues a report on where SNAP recipients work, and I found that 13.5% of Walmart employees in Ohio receive SNAP. I extrapolated those numbers nationally, and I found that about $618 million of SNAP benefits are going to Walmart employees. So we as a nation are subsidizing Walmart's profits by $600 million so they can pay their workers a pittance.
Is your argument essentially just anti-corporatist then, or is it more specific to this issue? It sounds like you have more of a problem with Walmart itself.
Well, you know, Walmart is really just the easiest and most obvious and most egregious example of this issue. It goes far beyond Walmart. You know, my argument isn't just anti-corporatist. It's that the anti-hunger community needs to engage in economic justice issues. All too often, food banks, for example, are the most powerful entities in their community, the largest entities in the community working on food issues, on hunger issues. Very few of them have actually weighed in on minimum wage issues. Most of them are staying in what I call a nutrition safety zone. They're staying in those policies that don't raise controversy, that don't alienate their donors, that don't alienate their board members, many of whom I found out that about one quarter of board members across the country of food banks work for a Fortune 1000 company, so they're highly integrated into those industries. So they're not willing to step out of their comfort zone to push for real substantive root change work that needs to happen around hunger. So in a sense, by not doing so, by addressing the symptom of the problem, which is what hunger is. Hunger is a symptom of poverty. They are not, they're kicking the can down the road. They're perpetuating the problem. They're keeping themselves in business because it's good for them and it's good for their donors in the corporate world. So we're perpetuating hunger. We're maintaining hunger because it's good for business at all levels.
So you're suggesting that it's in the interests of food banks, again, in your view, and this is an interview where we're having a one-on-one conversation here, and we would love to have input from others, but this is just the format we have right now. You're suggesting that food banks, in some cases, have it in their interest to not solve the problem.
Exactly. Absolutely. Food banks will often talk about wanting to put themselves out of business. But they won't necessarily dedicate the resources to the solutions that will put themselves out of business. They're stuck in kind of what's called a feed the need model. You know, as more people are coming to their door, oh, we got to raise the food to feed them, which is, you know, a very legitimate approach. And, you know, we all want to avert human suffering. We all want, we don't want to see anyone go hungry. We want to see people be able to pay their light bills and be able to put gas in their car and feed their kids. I mean, that's obviously, you know, the humanistic approach to this. But at the same time, if all you do is that, you're just digging yourself deeper into a rut, which the problem gets bigger and bigger and bigger. And that's what we've seen over the years. Is food banks started in the early 1980s as a temporary response to a social crisis, to high unemployment, to a deep recession, to cutbacks in the food stamp program by the Reagan administration. And they've snowballed out of control. And even in the past 12 years or so, the amount of food that food banks are distributing is twice what it was 12 years ago. One level, that's great. One level, they're helping to be more efficient and to meet the need. But on another level, they're not really solving the problem.
I could imagine one potential response from the other side would be your criticism of the corporate board members being on the boards of food banks. Wouldn't there be an outcry if corporate America weren't involved?
There probably would be an outcry if corporate America wasn't involved. Absolutely. People want to see corporations having some social responsibility, right? But the question from my perspective is, how do you define that social responsibility? In the case of many food industry players, it's paying their workers a pittance and then donating money through their foundation arm. Is that socially responsible? Or, just to think about it, there's an example here in Portland where there's a grocery chain called New Seasons, which, is relatively community-oriented, has been putting a lot of money into its philanthropy, has decided to back off that community philanthropy and put more money into paying its workers, and now it offers a starting wage of $13 an hour. I think that's one example of how things could be different.
Are there examples of food banks and nonprofits on the other side of the equation that are doing a good job, in your opinion, or models to follow?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I don't mean to paint a picture of doom and gloom at all here, but the point, what's going on is the food banking industry is transforming very rapidly and in generally very positive ways. Many food banks are redefining themselves to be health providers. In Santa Barbara County, they're very much moving in that direction. Many food banks are moving towards more political advocacy, such as in Alameda County and here in Portland, the Oregon Food Bank. In Rochester, New York, one of my favorite examples, they're buying apples from upstate New York from farmers there, packaging them, cutting them up, and packaging them and selling them to the schools. So kids are eating fresh local apples. They're making a little bit of money off of it. The farmers are making some money, and they're able to invest that into a catering business to serve healthier meals. So a lot of food banks are moving into economic development, into community support programs, community gardens, food policy councils, farm to school, whole wide variety of activities that they're engaged in.
There have been recent stories in the news with the Trump administration and its proposed changes to national food policy. The Farm Bill also, as it progresses, is going to be talking about these things. The Trump plan to move support towards a model that some have compared to Blue Apron. What's your opinion on that proposal?
Sure. The Trump administration wants to split the benefits of SNAP recipients, that they would be able to spend half of their budget at grocery stores, and the other half would be what they call a harvest box, which is a box of canned and fruits and vegetables and dried goods. Besides the fact that it's logistically impossible to do that for 40 million people, it is mean-spirited and it is not dignified. The administration is treating the poor as if they were children, as if they couldn't make good decisions at the grocery store. I feel like that program is more directed towards driving people off SNAP rather than trying to help them meet their own needs.
But the issue of poor decisions, isn't that one that knows no class? We've seen that as health outcomes are a problem in many communities. Is that maybe a legitimate issue, not necessarily limited to any one class of people or necessarily those who receive food stamps, but isn't there some kernel of an issue there?
Yeah, I make bad food decisions every day, right? I eat things I shouldn't eat every day. So, yes, we as a society have a poor diet, right? There is some evidence that shows that lower income Americans have a worse diet than middle income Americans and Americans in general, and you can attribute that to many factors: to culture, to education, to access, to affordability. There's lots of different reasons for that. And there's been a lot of discussions about whether soda should continue to be within the SNAP program. In some ways, I favor those exclusions. But what the Trump administration is trying to do with the Harvest Box is not provide people with healthy food, but really provide people with some of the worst processed stuff that we're no longer eating as a country. It may be cheap to produce, but it's just not. It's out of favor, and it doesn't take into account, and it can't take into account people's dietary preferences and culinary needs and health preferences. It would just be a generic standardized box that doesn't take into account whether a family might have members with diabetes or are vegetarians or you know, or heart disease or what have you.
Again, we've been talking with author Andrew Fisher. He is the author of the book Big Hunger, The Unholy Alliance Between Corporate America and Anti-Hunger Groups. He'll be speaking at Food Link of Tulare County in Exeter Friday night. You can find information on that event on the web at foodlinktc.org. And you can find Andy's book wherever books are sold. Again, Big Hunger, author Andrew Fisher joining us today. Andrew, thanks so much.
Sure, my pleasure. Thanks again, Joe.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Joe Moore. School discipline has long been a hot issue in the Valley. A few years ago, the Kern High School District made headlines for the high number of suspensions and expulsions in the district. Then there was a lawsuit filed by the Dolores Huerta Foundation and other groups alleging the district was discriminating against students of color by suspending and expelling them at higher rates than white students. Eventually, the two parties settled, and part of the agreement was expansion of a program called PBIS, basically an alternative to suspension that allows students and others to work out their problems in a circle. Suspension and expulsion numbers wound up dropping dramatically, but some say it's gone too far, and that's where our next guest comes in. Harold Pierce, writing in the Bakersfield Californian, reports that at least 10 teachers at Kern High School District campuses have been assaulted by students this year alone. Some say that number might even be higher. He joins us now to tell us more. Harold, welcome.
Hi, Joe. Thanks for having me.
Harold, the number that's in your report in the Californian really jumps off the page, at least 10 assaults this year. Do we have any idea if that is up or down from prior years? What's the context here?
It's unclear whether this is in line with other years at this point, but I think that if you talk to any teachers at all, they would say that one assault is way too many. And really, a lot of them, particularly at Bakersfield High School, are placing blame on this PBIS called Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports. And basically, it's a program that it's really a systems approach is what they call it, where they try to curb poor behavior by trying to get at the root and address the issue. So if a student is acting out, they don't automatically give them a referral for willful defiance or anything like that. Instead, they go ahead and they put them in a room, they put them in what they call a restorative circle, they talk out the issue with whomever they might have wronged, and they create a path to go ahead and try to address that behavior moving forward. There's been a lot of proof this has helped in their districts, but teachers at BHS say that this is kind of having the opposite effect and that, in fact, students are really emboldened to go ahead and kind of flout the rules.
Now, there's a state law that has been implemented over willful defiant suspensions that's about to lapse, and that's a subject of the legislature right now. But this issue of willful defiant suspensions and PBIS, as I understand it, the policies in place right now would still allow for expulsions of students who committed violence in the classroom, correct?
Certainly, yes.
So the students who are doing that aren't being put in the circle.
No, those students are not being put in the circle. I think if they're assaulting teachers, typically that is certainly an expellable offense.
But the concern is that there's a progression of behavior, and that is especially at Bakersfield High right now the concern from your reporting.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And you know, teachers blame the PBIS approach. Principals are really. They don't believe that's actually the case. And they're saying this has more to do with willful defiance going away than anything else. And a few years back, the state legislature decided to go ahead and take that away. You can no longer suspend or refer a student for willful defiance anymore. It used to be that if a kid would fall asleep in class or, you know, willfully defy a teacher's orders in any way, they could be suspended for that. And I think in part the reason why VHS's numbers and Kern High School District's numbers were so high is because the moment you got to 21 days of suspension in a single year, you were immediately expelled. So they've tried to curb that a lot. And I think what principals are saying is that teachers are very frustrated right now because they've had that tool taken away from them. They don't necessarily know how to better that behavior without being able to immediately remove a student from their class by giving them a willful defiant suspension.
Harold, you open your story telling us about one assault that took place on the campus of Bakersfield High School, where a PE teacher was assaulted a little more than a year ago. What happened there? Give us an example of some of the conduct that you're reporting on here.
Yeah, what had happened with Terry Chapman is he was a PE teacher, and he had a student who tried to leave class early. Chapman tried to stop him, tried to tell him not to leave. That student cussed and swore at him, told him he was going to kick his effing you-know-what. And Chapman told me that he said, you don't need to speak to me that way. We can resolve this the same way that TBI tells him that he should be responding to a student who's acting out in this way. And the response from that student was, talk to Chapman, punch him in the face, and then he tackled him to the ground. And what Chapman has told me is that PE teachers are really the ones who are dealing with the brunt of these issues, because typically what happens at BHS, he said, is when a student walks out of class, they don't feel like being there anymore, which happens on, you know, a weekly basis, at least a couple times. They'll go ahead and they'll go to the PE area because it's easy to blend in. There's a lot of kids already out there, and it's just kind of an easy way to get away from your classroom environment. That's what happened with Chapman. These are the particularly frustrating for PE teachers who are dealing with it kind of in larger numbers than just than any other classroom teacher.
So how about the implementation of this PBIS system since the settlement of this lawsuit? The system was already to some degree in place in Kern High School District campuses before that, right? How is it rolled out since then?
Yeah, it certainly was. Certain schools had it. DHS, I think, was the very first high school in the Kern High School District to begin implementing this. And what's really important to know about PBIS is this is not a 3-month implementation process. This is about a 3-year implementation process. It takes some time to get these systems in place and get kids, you know, used to this this behavioral approach. I'm not sure if it's necessarily changed since the lawsuit was settled, but I think that the perception has been that since the lawsuit went ahead and got settled, that things have changed. They haven't, in fact. But teachers are saying that because of that lawsuit, principals are more apprehensive to go about suspending and expelling students, particularly those of color.
So with concerns about classroom safety, teacher safety, what is the district doing? What's their response?
Yeah, it's unclear what kind of concrete response is going to come out of this from the district. They said they're going to be meeting with teacher leaders and trying to address their concerns moving forward. I know that the faculty members who were assaulted, Mr. Chapman certainly has gotten a mediator. He's not risen to the level of getting a lawyer. It's unclear at this point how involved the union is. I guess they're not very involved in this process. But what's interesting to note is that there are 10 teachers who have been assaulted that are on record. Kern High School District Trustee Mike Williams said that if that's the number that are on record, he's willing to bet there's many more that have gone unreported. I don't know where he's gathering those figures from, but he's a trustee in that district, and you know, I get the sense that he probably knows better than we do the number of assaults and disciplinary issues happening there.
Again, we're talking with Harold Pierce of the Bakersfield Californian today. Are there legal ramifications for the district in this? We talked about the lawsuit that was filed over alleged discrimination and disproportionate suspensions and expulsions of minority students. What about any potential legal liability from the teacher side?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, Joe. I think the district kind of got themselves between a rock and a hard place right now. You know, it was a few years ago that they were expelling students at these record numbers, and they got themselves sued on behalf of students. And they went ahead and they addressed the issue, and now they're having, you know, students who are assaulting teachers, and teachers are now saying that this is a hostile work environment. They're scared to come to class. You know, Chapman had to go to the hospital after he was assaulted. He had a bad knee already, and that particular situation where he was tackled to the ground exacerbated it, he had said. So at this point, the teachers are saying that the district is in violation of their union agreement to ensure a safe workplace. How far it will go from here is unclear. I get the impression they're trying to resolve this without getting into any kind of legal ramifications.
Fascinating story, and you can read it online at Bakersfield.com and in the print edition of the Bakersfield Californian Harold Pierce reporting on a new wave of assaults against teachers from students at campuses in the Kern High School District. At least 10 teachers assaulted by students this year, according to Harold's reporting, and the problem extends beyond that as well. Harold, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me, Joe.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. As always, let us know what you think. Send us an email, talk@kvpr.org, and find our podcast also at kvpr.org. For Valley Edition producer and reporter Laura Tsutsui, reporters Carrie Klein and Christina Lopez, audio engineer Marv Allen, and production and operations director Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, accepting nominations now for the 2019 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. The California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need, on the web at chcf.org. And the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org.